Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Once again, thanks for joining me as we take a deep dive into the cardboard boxes stored in the backs of our closets. Or perhaps some of us are showcasing them a little more than I am. I have two young kids, so I don't quite have my own room once again where I can leave this stuff out there. But they're still in the collection. You still have your collection, or perhaps you don't, but you remember certain things about it. And we're going to have a lot of fun going back to the 1950s in this week's show as we take a deeper look at some of the earliest Topps sets, 1952, 53, and 54 Topps. Not only a seminal time period for the Topps chewing gum company, but also for the hobby, as a lot of the standards for a baseball card were established with these Topps cards, and standards that still remain true to this day. 65 years later, Topps still makes their cards this way, and even non-baseball cards, you know, other sports or the unofficially licensed cards that Panini makes or anybody else, they're all roughly the same size and carry a lot of the same information that the sets that Topps created in the mid-1950s did. And it really turned the hobby up from just a random collection of pictures of sports heroes and, more importantly, your favorite bubblegum, into a hobby where people started collecting these things and started trying to acquire entire sets through collection. So we're going to talk about 52, 53, and 54 Topps. I've got one from 52, one from 53, and four from 54. Now, if you're a longtime listener of the podcast, you know that the full 1954 breakdown is in episode number 69. My one 1954 Topps card I had back then was of Joe Coleman, not Joe Coleman Jr., who you're probably more familiar with, who was a pitcher in the 70s and 80s, but Joe Coleman Sr., yes, his father, who was pitching for the quote-unquote new Baltimore Orioles back in 1954. Of course, the Orioles moving from St. Louis, nay, the Browns. So we can give you a full breakdown of 54 Topps in that episode, but we'll give you the short and skinny version of 52, 53, and 54 in this week's program. Now, before we look at these cards, an interesting topic of conversation through our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed, actually through a DM, which we'll get to in a moment. And also, I just want to give you a heads up on next week's show. This is going to be a really fun show next week because I just purchased online a 3-pack cello lot. And I'm not going to give it away just yet, because I think when you see the poll come out on Monday, and yes, I know Monday is Labor Day, but just follow along with me on this. I'm still going to put the poll up there because I think it'll be a fun thing for you to do on your extended holiday weekend, and it'll be fun to open these packs. I will tell you they're from the 1980s, early to mid-80s, but they are 3 packs, one of, you know, each from different sets and different years. And normally when I put up 3 packs, the oldest one gets the most votes. And again, that's just a natural thing. Collectors just like looking at the old cards first, and then, you know, the younger cards, there's a little bit of a battle to see which one gets the second place finish. And then we open up the first and second place packs and we see what's inside. This may be the one election that we have where the oldest cello pack may not win. And it's not because it's a bad one, but it's because the two younger cello packs are a little more popular, tend to have bigger hits in terms of rookie cards and early career cards. And I'm curious how that's going to play out. So be on the lookout starting Monday, Labor Day. It'll probably be late in the morning on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. We will post the poll with your three options. You pick the one that you like, and the top two vote getters, we will open those packs in next week's show. We are back for the summer, and thanks again to everybody who's reached out and has had some kind comments on the program. Really appreciate all the feedback. Glad that everybody is able to follow along once again. And I ask you if you can do me one favor, it's just tell a friend about the podcast. I just want to try to get the listening numbers up once again. A lot of people, you know, when you take the break that we took, which was a little over, or what was it, 9 months, you know, you're out of sight, you're out of mind. So, you know, some people just kind of lose touch with you. So if you know somebody who collects now or who used to collect back in the day, tell them about Wax Ecstatic. The shows post Fridays, noon Eastern, along with the video links. And you can follow us at any time on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. And we do have a few new listening platforms available. We mentioned this in last week's show. We are now on the Google Play podcast list. You can also listen to us on Spotify and also our usual zones to listen to: iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Blueberry, and also our home base, which is Audio Boom. So plenty of different ways to listen to us. Add us to your RSS feed. Have these shows download right into your phone or whatever piece of equipment you're listening to these podcasts on. And don't just tell a friend about us, but whether you listen on iTunes or Spotify or TuneIn or iHeartRadio or whatever, if there's an opportunity to comment on the show, to rate the show, please do, because that does help get the word out even more. If you really like the show and you give us 5 stars or whatever the rating system is on the platform you listen to, if you do that, then what typically happens is those positive votes start moving the show up the ladder for recommended searches. And we end up getting a few more listeners that way, and I would greatly appreciate that. Also, thanks to those who have made cash donations through our PayPal account. Just got one earlier this week. Thank you very much to the person who made that. A little bit of a cash investment in the program. As I've said before, this money does not go right into my pocket. I'm not living high off the hog on this show, trust me. But what we do is take this money and, first of all, for the technical needs of the program, such as hosting on Audio Boom and keeping our archive alive and, you know, just some of the operational costs that goes to that, but also purchasing some of these packs that we get to open. And if we get a little extra capital coming in, we get to do things a little more exciting than 89 Tops. Nothing wrong with 89 Tops. I love it. But again, if we get a few extra bucks coming our way, then we can forge around for the, a 78 Tops wax pack or something like that. So if you want to make a cash donation, whether it's just a couple of bucks or a little more, you can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that is paypal.me/waxecstatic. And if you have already donated, thank you, thank you, thank you. If you haven't yet, if you find it in your heart and wallet to donate a couple of bucks, we thank you in advance. Now, before we look at the mid-50s Topps cards and talk about the sets themselves and the players, I had a great question posed this past week by C.D. Anderson, big Tigers fan who follows the show. And this actually started as a DM via Wax and Gum Stains, and I asked his permission if we could discuss this on the show, and he said yes. Now, in the last program where we opened up the 86 and 89 Fleer Cellos, I pulled out of one of the packs a George Bell card and mentioned that Bell, one of the outfielders for the Toronto Blue Jays in the mid to late 80s, very underrated outfield that consisted of George Bell and Lloyd Mosby and Jesse Barfield. Even though Bell was the weakest link in terms of defense of that outfield, it was an outstanding outfield for that team. Doesn't quite get the credit that they're due. But George Bell still had a phenomenal 1987 season, which won him the American League MVP award. And C.D. Anderson asked me, "Hey, Matt, last episode was great. As a Jays fan, how do you feel about George Bell's MVP in 87? Tiger fans feel like Trammell was robbed. Interested in the Jays fan take on it." Well, great question, and a little bit of clarification and full disclosure. I was a Jays fan growing up. Ever since I moved back to Tampa back in 1999, I've become a Rays fan. And still, you know, you have that emotional attachment to the Blue Jays. But in my life, it's Tampa Bay Rays first. And the Blue Jays provided some great memories for me when I was younger. But also, full disclosure, in 1987, I was nine, becoming 10 years old that October. I was just getting into professional sports. So 87 going into 88, that's kind of when the switch flipped for me, where I went from just kind of liking sports like any other kid does into, you know, just soaking in sports and not necessarily playing sports in my life, even though I did play sports. I wasn't like an all-around athlete, but in just learning about the history and the stats and the rules and the players and the teams and the logos and the uniforms, all that stuff. This was, the 1987 season was kind of the very, very beginning of when I got into this. So my first recollection of the 1987 season, when I fatefully decided to select the Blue Jays as my team of choice, is the Tigers beating the Blue Jays in the last weekend of the season at Tiger Stadium to win the American League East and go on to the playoffs, where they would eventually lose to the eventual world champion Minnesota Twins. So in terms of which team got shafted, you guys at least got to the playoffs that year. So, you know, that's a little bit of a, you know, sore spot for the Blue Jays, who by then were starting to get a reputation as the Blow Jays, because they had problems, if not holding on to leads in playoff series, looking at you, 1985, then holding a lead going into the final few days of the season, which cost them the playoffs. And, you know, the Jays wouldn't exercise those ghosts until 1992. But, you know, you do bring up a good question. And while my lifetime connection to the George Bell, was he really an MVP question, is a little bit kind of up there in the air, I thought it was a great question that I wanted to dive into, because almost every year there is an argument as for, why did this player win this award as opposed to that player? And I can remember just a couple years ago, the Rick Porcello and Justin Verlander dust up. Everybody thought Verlander was going to win. Speaking of former Tigers, everybody thought he was going to win the Cy Young Award in 2016, and then Porcello wins it in Boston. And there was a lot of outrage. A lot of people were upset, including Kate Upton, who infamously tweeted her thoughts about it. And let's be honest, Justin Verlander, as long as he's coming home to Kate Upton, I mean, when is he not winning? You know, I mean, the Cy Young Award's just a, you know, hardware when you think about it. Kate Upton's a different type of trophy. But anywho, the MVP award, and this isn't just in baseball, but in all sports, there's a very good argument. A good old sports talk radio staple: is the MVP the best player of the league, or is the MVP the best player on his team, and of the collection of the best players, is the best of the best players the MVP of a league? And you can go back and forth, and there's really no wrong answer. You can make a good argument for either side. But looking back at 1987, at first, I wasn't thinking about George Bell and Alan Trammell. I was thinking about the controversy with the National League MVP award, and we'll get to that in a moment. But let's talk Bell and Trammell. So if you look at the traditional stats of baseball, George Bell was certainly MVP worthy, as he played in 156 games. He was not a designated hitter. He was a full-time outfielder for the Blue Jays at the time. And he had 188 hits, hit 47 home runs, 134 RBI, batted .308, had a OPS of .957. So it should be no surprise that he got 16 first place votes and an 85% share of the vote, where he nudged out Alan Trammell by a grand total of 21 points. Trammell finished with 311 points and 12 first place votes. Now, if you look at some of the traditional baseball stats for Alan Trammell in 1987, he hit .343, didn't hit as many home runs or drive in as many runs, had 28 homers, 105 RBI, had almost as many runs scored as Bell. Bell had 111, Trammell had 109. Trammell played almost as many games, 151 to 156. Just had 13 fewer at-bats, 610 to 597. But you can look at Alan Trammell and go, well, he had more hits, 205 to 188. He had a better on-base percentage, 402 to 352. His OPS was almost the same as Bell, 957 to 953. He had more stolen bases. He drew more walks. He didn't strike out as much as Bell. And we all know when it comes to defense, Alan Trammell was far more dependable out in the field than George Bell. Now, it helps when you have Lou Whitaker to your side for many of those games. But again, you know, Bell had some pretty good compadres out in the outfield for Toronto as well, with Barfield and Mosby. So this is where I think a lot of these arguments get rehashed. It's the advanced stats, which in 1987 were not as prevalent. And you look at the biggest advanced stat, and one that's so easy to compare one player to the other, and that's WAR, wins above replacement. And George Bell, his WAR for 87 was a 5.0. Trammell was an 8.2. So if you're using wins above replacement, not only does Trammell have a clear advantage over George Bell, but also with the kind of the benchmarks for WAR, where if you have a five, that's considered a pretty good, you know, an all-star worthy season. But in order to get MVP, you need to be eight or above. If you're looking at wins above replacement, then yeah, you have a pretty good argument for Trammell. And you also have the good argument that Trammell helped get his team to the postseason, which is, you know, after all, that's what you're playing for, right? So there's a very good argument to be made that Alan Trammell should have gotten the MVP in the American League in 1987 over George Bell. Now, I'm going to return to that argument in just a moment, but let's look back at the National League in 1987. There's a lot of controversy here as well, as Andre Dawson, in his second season with the Chicago Cubs, had a career year in 87. Batted 287, 49 home runs, 137 RBI, appeared in 153 games, had 178 hits, had an OPS of 896. I mean, this was peak Andre Dawson. Everybody remembers Hawk when he was with Montreal, but he was just raking with the Cubs in the late 80s. The problem is, the Cubs were just horse crap. They were terrible in 1987. And that goes back to the argument of, you know, is the MVP the best player on a team or the best player in the league? And you would hear this argument again a few years later in 1991 with Cal Ripken Jr. and the American League MVP. The Orioles were a terrible team in 91. Was he really MVP worthy? Now, the argument for the National League MVP was Andre Dawson against two qualified candidates, both with the St. Louis Cardinals, a team that would win the National League pennant in 87, a team that was a consistent contender throughout the early to mid 80s, and a team that had an all-star fielder and hell of a hitter in Ozzie Smith, who, as it turned out, finished second in the voting, and then had a terror in the outfield and at the plate, and depending who you asked, in the locker room, in Jack the Ripper Clark. Clark would finish third place in the voting. And the vote points look like this. It was not as close in the National League. Dawson had 269 points, 11 first place votes. Smith had 193 points, but 9 first place votes. And Clark was right behind Smith with 186 points and 3 first place votes. And you can make the argument, you know, if you look again at the traditional stats, that Clark was offensively just as good and in some categories better than Andre Dawson. Ozzie Smith was the more complete player. Not only was he very dependable to get on base, but he was a guy who could lead the way defensively as well. After all, he was the Wizard of Oz. But again, we look at wins above replacement. Andre Dawson, despite the spectacular season, a 4.0. Smith, 6.4. Clark, 5.4. So if you do wins above replacement, then Smith or Clark should have been given more consideration than Andre Dawson. But I will also argue this, Cardinals fans. If you're going with the wins above replacement argument, then there's probably a good argument for Tony Gwynn, who led in that department with an 8.6 and who hit 370 that year, to be much closer in the running. He finished a distant eighth in the voting. Also scoring high in the WAR category, Eric Davis with a 7.9, Tim Raines a 6.7, Darryl Strawberry a 6.4. And they were not anywhere near the voting that Dawson, Smith, or Clark were. So again, it's not as evident as Bell versus Trammell, but on the National League side, Dawson versus Smith and or Clark, there's a compelling argument that you can make for any of those three guys where you say, no, this person really should have been considered for the award more than Andre Dawson in that really bad Chicago Cubs team. Now, let me summarize the discussion with this. First of all, even though I grew up a Blue Jays fan and you're a Tigers fan, I'm not going to pit one side against the other. I really don't think there's a wrong answer here, you know, unless you're picking somebody who, you know, if you're picking Dave Valle for the American League MVP in 1987, that's the wrong answer. No offense to Dave Valle, but you get my drift. there's really no wrong answer in that there are good supporting statements with either traditional stats, advanced stats, team performance, how much did the player help his team get to the promised land. There's a lot of good arguments either way. But I think with hindsight being 2020, here's why I think Andre Dawson and George Bell won the MVP awards in their respective leagues that year. 1987 was near the end of the speedy, artificial turf, defensively strong power pitching era of baseball. We were just a few years away from, I hate to say it, the steroid era, which, you know, you could officially say came around in 1990 or so. But this was, speaking of Cardinals, this was Whitey Ball. Whitey Herzog made a killing in St. Louis, got one World Series victory in 82, appeared in two more in 85 and 87, where, the Cardinals utilized the huge space in Busch Stadium to their advantage. They utilized the AstroTurf. They utilized the good but not power hitters, players like Ozzie Smith, Willie McGee, Vince Coleman. You know, you could have your slap hitters on that team as well as the power hitters like Jack Clark or Pedro Guerrero. Terry Pendleton was kind of a mix of both, although I think he was, you know, you could chalk him up as more of a contact hitter than a power hitter, although he could go deep more often than not. But, you know, the Cardinals specialized that in the mid-80s. And you look at a lot of the teams that either won World Series or made it to the playoffs in the mid-80s. You look at the Cardinals, you look at the Royals, you look at the Astros, you look at the Twins, you look at the Blue Jays. There were a lot of teams that specialized in that station to station, get the slap hitters on first, bring up a big gun in the fourth or fifth slot in the batting order. And, those teams were able to use speed and good defense up the middle. And again, for the most part, very large stadiums. They were able to utilize that to much success. In 1987, you suddenly had a resurgence in power hitting. As I mentioned, Dawson had 49 home runs. Bell had 47 home runs. Don't forget, that was the year Mark McGwire, as a rookie, hit 49 home runs. This was extremely unusual. You had some other pretty big power numbers. Dale Murphy with 44 home runs that year. Darryl Strawberry with 39 home runs that year. Dwight Evans with 34 home runs. Darryl Evans, Wally Joyner, Kent Urbach, Danny Tartable, each 34 home runs. So for the first time in about 10 years, you know, George Foster was, up until Cecil Fielder, the last player to hit 50 home runs in this era. This was a stretch of time where defense, speed, station to station, small ball, if you will, dominated, and other teams mimicked it because it worked. And that was what was leading the way, as well as power pitching. Let's not forget, this is when, you know, Nolan Ryan was still chugging along, but, you know, Roger Clemens, Dwight Gooden, some of the most powerful arms of the time are leading the way. Eventually, you would have Oral Hershiser come around with the Dodgers. You know, there's numerous ace pitchers at this time who just controlled the game. So the long ball was almost long forgotten in a lot of cases in the early to mid-80s. So I think that the writers who vote for the MVP award, I think the writers just got caught up in the razzle-dazzle of the power hitter in 1987. And again, you know, we lose sight of that because starting in the late 80s and running throughout the 90s and the early 2000s, again, the steroid era, where home run records are falling left and right, you know, hitting 34 home runs seems kind of quaint when you think of all the 50-plus home run hitters Major League Baseball had 15, 20 years ago. So to answer your question, CD, I think that, you know, again, you could make the argument that, no, Bell deserved it or Wade Trammell should have deserved it. But I think it's just you have to look at the context. In 1987, even though you had home run hitters, this was the first time in a very long time that you had several hitters threatening to hit 50 home runs. And this was the first time in a long time that teams decided power is a very big thing in the game. And you would see that shift, steroids or not, in the late 80s. Look at the teams that were making the playoffs then. The Oakland Athletics, you had McGuire, you had Canseco. You look at the San Francisco Giants, Will Clark, Matt Williams, just to name a couple. The Blue Jays had their power hitters as well, George Bell being one of them. And, you know, later they would acquire guys like Joe Carter to hit home runs. And, you know, you even look at the Boston Red Sox, Mike Greenwell, Alice Burks, Dwight Evans, who was still plugging away in the late 80s. You know, a lot of the teams that got to the playoffs, yes, they had pitching. Certainly, all those teams I mentioned had some pretty good pitching. But it wasn't just speed and defense. The long ball was starting to carry its weight in this game as the approach to winning shifted. And I think 1987 was the start of that. And I think the writers just got caught up in being impressed by the home run ball. So that's my answer. I'm not going to defend Bell or Trammell. You have good arguments for either, likewise in the National League with Dawson, Smith, or Clark. But I just think it was just that time. All of a sudden, home runs were getting hit with regularity once again, and that captivated the certainly the writers and the nationwide audience as well. If you have any questions, you don't have to send a DM, although you're more than welcome to. You can just post it at Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed, which is open 24/7 for your hobby and baseball commentary. And of course, if you have any questions, comments, thoughts, or suggestions for the show, we take them at Wax and Gum Stains as well. All right, I've got one card from 1952 Tops, one card from 1953 Tops, and four 1954 Tops. Let's take a look at them right now. My one 1952 Tops card, and the dealer that I bought this from has a lot more now because even the common cards are priced a little higher even in the half-off bin. I only purchased one, but as time goes on, I will accumulate a few more of these. This is Vic Wertz. We're going to talk about Vic Wertz later on. In fact, we're going to talk about all these players later on. But the Vic Wertz card, in almost very good condition. The only thing is, as you can see, a couple of scuff marks here. Could have been a piece of gum, could have just been tape or glue or just something that dropped on there. But other than that, this card is in incredible condition for going on, what now, 66 years. Great photography here, good colorized photo of Vic when he was with the Detroit Tigers. I'll flip it over on the back here, and you can see a lot of narrative, a lot of talking here, but something that Topps did that Bowman wasn't doing back then was
putting in stats. This was very revolutionary at the time. This was now a new way of getting stats for players. Certainly looking back, if you wanted updated stats, you waited for the sporting news or the baseball news to come in the mail. But this was revolutionary at the time, highlighting the player's previous season, the lifetime stats, but also having the fielding numbers too, which is something that would come and go on the backs of baseball cards. I think the back of this card's in pretty good shape, slightly off center. There's a little discoloration here, maybe from some wax. But again, for a 52 Topps card, this is in incredible condition. And I got this with half off. And of course, this damage here is the reason why it's lower than book price. Got it for $5. So again, I'm not a big stickler on condition. So a 1952 Topps baseball card of a pretty good player in Vic Wertz for $5 is an absolute steal. Now, just for comparison purposes, and we did this in the 52 Bowman show. So here's Vic Wertz. Here's the 52 Bowman card. And you place one over the other. And again, it's almost picture in picture here. So Bowman had its work cut out for them with 52 Topps rolled out, and that's why 53 Bowman, the cards were larger. There were full-color photographs, Kodachrome film, no longer the smaller cards that were hand-painted photographs. They would take a photo negative and paint over it in color paint. So while these cards are nice, pale in comparison to what Topps put out. And 1953 was also the year that Bowman got away from just the narrative and the advertising, the self-serving advertising, and with the backs of their cards very similarly to Topps, added some statistics along with the narrative here. So 52 Topps, we'll talk more about that set in a little bit, but this is just an absolute beauty of a card, and to finally hold one in my hands and see this work of art, it's really great to be able to do that. And especially, you know, knowing the sad story of how Topps didn't actually sell real well in 1952. And a lot of the original product was thrown away. And of course, you've got mothers everywhere throwing out kids' baseball card collections. So to have an actual card from 52 is awesome. It's not Mickey Mantle, but I'll take Vic Wertz. Now, my 1953 card, I'm going to take it out of the holder because the price tags on the holder is ridiculous. Very interesting story of Cliff Fannin. We'll get to him in a little bit. Anytime you can get a St. Louis Browns card, especially with the Brownie logo, that is a bonus. This is, of course, when Bill Veeck ran the St. Louis Browns, the final season that he did, the final season of the St. Louis Browns, and it would turn out 1952 was actually the final season in the major leagues for Cliff Fannin. He wasn't even playing in the bigs in 1953. But we flip the card over, and you see why 53 Topps is a legendary set. You know, let's compare it to 1952. So again, 52 stats, stories, nice look. 1953, you've got it all. You've got stats, you've got this little trivia box, you've got a little bit of narrative. Unfortunately, with the dark cardstock and the red facsimile autograph on top of it, it's kind of hard to read this. And then you've got, you know, the big card number up here, the personal information in the upper right-hand corner. It is very easy to see why 53 Topps is well-loved and why there have been so many recreations of 53 Topps. The first Topps Archives set, which was released in the early 1990s, was a recreation, a glossy version of the 53 Topps set. And of course, the Topps Now set is designed like 53 Topps. It is a set that, you know, again, compared to 52, you still have a nice big card. In fact, it's the same size. You have the in 53, they kind of went back to the paintings, but the artwork is so tremendous, and it's just full of color. It's popping with color. You've got the team logo on there. You've got all this information on the back. It's easy to read. A little bit of a gum or a wax stain up here, but still, you know, again, this is one of those cards you pick up for a couple dollars in the half off bin, and it is an absolute beaut. And I've got a great story about Cliff Fannin, who in many ways lived up to the legend that is the St. Louis Browns. All right, let's take a look at our 1954 cards real quickly. We did talk about 1954 in a previous episode, but some interesting cards here. This one of Johnny Logan, who you could call Mr. Milwaukee. We'll explain why in a little bit, but an all-star shortstop for the Milwaukee Braves for many, many, many years. In fact, he would become a mainstay in Milwaukee, started in Milwaukee with the AAA Brewers before the Braves moved into town. I love the front of the 54 cards because you've got the dual action shot. So you have the colorized photo, but then you've got the black and white quote-unquote action shot. This was, again, very revolutionary for what baseball cards were doing. By 1954, Bowman was looking similar to 52 Topps, but in 54, Topps is just totally outclassing Bowman in design, and as you know by now, outsigning players to exclusive contracts. So you've got the colorized photo that dominates the picture. You've got the black and white action photo cropped in the background. You've got a very colorful background, a 1950s palette here. You've got the old Braves logo. You've got the player name, position, and team. And then the backs of the cards are just incredible. So, you know, again, let's take a look at 53 compared to 54. So 1954, it's a little easier to read with the color selection. Also, the cardstock, and this is something that was problematic in the 50s, you would have some white cardstock and some gray cardstock. Now, this is actually white cardstock. It's pretty well-worn. But you've got the narrative, you've got the stats, but you also have the legendary cartoons. You know, here you got a cartoon with trivia, but a lot of the cartoons of 54 Topps revolved around the player pictured on the front. And we were talking about cartoon art in a previous episode. You'll notice in 1954 and throughout the mid-50s, the cartoons were kind of comic book or pulp fiction style. It's a very 1950s look, almost a heroic look to these baseball players here. So you have the story of Johnny Logan, or John Logan Jr., as his legal name is, and it's not only told out in narrative form and statistic form, but this really neat little three-panel cartoon. So we'll talk more about Johnny Logan a little bit. A very interesting card from the Milwaukee Braves I have here. Bob Keeley, great story behind him. We'll get to him. Now, I mock the dreaded manager card, but I thought this was neat. This is a coach card. Bob Keeley was actually the bullpen coach for the Milwaukee Braves. Had been a bullpen coach for many years, but as I'll tell you in his life's story, was a star in high school, was destined to have a great baseball career until injury shortened that. But then World War II actually helped him out, getting back into the big leagues and a longtime major league career. So again, even though he's a coach, you've got his lifetime statistics, his one at-bat. I'll tell you about that. You've got cartoons for the coach. You got the narrative here as well. And something else about the cards from the 1950s. Now, this is not the case here, but if we were to flip the card over to the left, you'll see, or it is the case, I should say, you will see that they don't match. So again, here, if I flip the card over to the left, so on this card on the left, you've got the narrative on the left. On this card on the right, the narrative's on the right. This is somewhat problematic for the collectors who like to organize their cards by numbers. Well, when you pull them out of the box, you've got one that's upside down and one that's right side up. So, again, some printing experimentation going on in 1954. But even for a coach card, again, there's special circumstances for Bob Keeley. Again, you get the colorized photo, you get the action shot. You've got a white backdrop here, so it's not quite as colorful as the Logan card, but a very neat presentation. Couple more cards real quickly. This card, you already know the story of Marion Fracano. We talked about Frick in our 1952 Bowman show. We had his 53 Bowman, or no, his 54 Bowman card. Well, here's his 54 Topps card. And again, the colorized picture, and he clearly looks like he's up to no good here. The action shot in the background. And the Philadelphia Athletics logo, which did survive through Kansas City and Oakland. The orange background here. And only two panels telling his life story. Of course, they probably don't want to get too in-depth about all of the players that he beamed with his wild pitches. And lastly, an interesting story that we'll share here, Bill Worley, a pitcher then with the Boston Red Sox. So colorized photo, action shot in the corner here. Nice color palette here, this kind of pale sky blue. I love this old Boston Red Sox logo. It's goofy, it's 1950s. It's also very phallic, so it gives everybody a nice little chuckle. Two panels describing his life story, but also the great layout here of the narrative, the stats. And I love the colors. I said this in the first podcast of 54 Tops we did. There is something about this green and red on white that really works. Topps would utilize this a couple more times in the 1950s, but it's a really good look, and especially on the white cardboard, it's a lot easier to read. So we're gonna talk about the individual lives, with the exception of Furcano, just because, again, we already talked about him, about these particular players in just a moment, and then preview next week's show. Let's talk about these 1952, 53, and 54 Topps sets and players first.
Now, as I mentioned, I'm going to be picking up more of these cards in the future. I first went through the half-off box, picking off as many $1 and $2 cards as possible just to increase the collection. And the next time I go, I'll be searching the box once again for some good bargains. You know, we'll enter the $4 to $5 stage for some of these cards. And I love the artwork, the colorized photo, the classic Tigers logo in the box in the lower left, and of course the facsimile autograph. And again, in 1952, and I've mentioned this about the Bowman cards too from that era, unless you lived in a major league city and had access to major league players, you weren't going to have a chance of getting an autograph, you know, unless you mailed a picture or something to a player to get signed. So we kind of laugh at the facsimile autographs now, but it's kind of big stuff in 1952. Love the tinted photographs, the logos, the autographs as well, and all the information on the back. And as I said while we were looking at this card, this was pretty revolutionary. This was the brainchild of a couple of the early leaders with Topps, and that would be the designer for the Topps company, then Woody Gelman, and also Cy Berger. And Cy Berger was long connected with Topps for 50 plus years. He actually passed away a couple of years ago. But Cy Berger is often called the father of modern baseball cards, and that's simply because of this 52 Topps set. You know, I showed you the 50 Bowman cards, the 1950 cards, and also showed you, the other Bowman cards from 51 and 52 a couple weeks ago. And they were, certainly the 51s and 52s, and you saw in the 1950s, the 1950 cards were just these little squares, almost the Cracker Jack baseball cards you used to get. But the 51 and 52 cards were essentially the same size and design and had the same sizzle as the old T206 tobacco cards from 50 years before. What Cy Berger did with the 1952 Topps card, while Cy gets the top billing, again, Woody Gelman, you have to give a lot of credit to. First of all, the cards were larger than life. And you saw me lay the Bowman card over the Topps card. 2.5 inches by 3.5 inches, that would become the standard size for baseball cards moving forward. Now, as I've mentioned before, Bowman would stick with a bigger size card in 1953. And when Bowman came back in 89, their cards were a little larger than the standard 2.5 inch by 3.5 inch. But this was something different. These were bigger, larger than life cards. And that was kind of the mindset of America post-war, post-World War II. Of course, we were still fighting the Korean War in 1952. But the nation was getting bigger and smaller at the same time. You know, everybody could afford a house. Everybody could afford a car. You had the interstate highway system that connected the nation like it never did before. Commercial airline business was growing. We were leaving propeller jets and moving to the propeller engines, I should say, and moving on to the jet engine age. It was a very progressive time, and all of a sudden America is feeling bigger, stronger, bolder. We not only won the war overseas, but we're going to win the war domestically, and everybody's going to have a car and a wife and 2.5 kids and a chicken in every pot. You know the old sayings, and this is kind of the whimsical, fanciful dream of the past that people think America was. Everything was not peaches and cream back in the 1950s. But boy, it seemed that way. Big, colorful, that was what the 1950s were about. And it wasn't just the cars or the suburban homes that people were moving to, but even baseball cards as well. The 1952 Topps set was a 407-card set, at least in terms of the base set. If you talk about the variations, and there's a lot of them, 145 to be exact, then the true size of the set is 552 cards if you collect every variation, which is very, very difficult to do. But, you know, the 52 Topps set is anchored by the legendary Mickey Mantle rookie card, a 407-card set hanging mostly on the Mantle card, but also in terms of the complete redesign of the standard baseball card, adding stats to the back, having narrative, big, colorful pictures, a beautiful design, and not just something that just seemed to be whipped up very quickly in the art department, like some of the Bowman cards from before. The problem with the 1952 Topps card set is it was not extremely popular, believe it or not. In fact, there is the legendary story, and I have brought it up a few times, that there was so much 52 Topps product just laying around the warehouses of the Topps company that Cy Berger had to take cases and cases of the set, especially the high numbered series, which, you know, just wasn't selling, and, you know, dump it into the Hudson River. So that's part of the reason why the 52 Topps set is very valuable as well. It's not just the Mantle card. It's not just the age. And this was a whole new look at baseball cards. But, well, there's a whole bunch that ended up turning into fish food in 1952. And that actually leads nicely into 1953, where because there was so much leftover product the year before, Topps drastically dials back the number of cards in the set. In fact, it was a 280-card set, although 6 of the cards were never printed. So technically, it's a 274-card set. And that is seriously down from 407 cards. Now, talking about bigger being supposedly better in the 1950s, the Topps Card Company actually decided to increase the size of the cards just a little bit to 2 5/8 inches and 3 3/4 inches. So if you overlay a 52 and a 53 Topps card, you will see that they are slightly larger, and Topps would stick with this for a couple of years. But even though it is a smaller set, it is still an incredibly popular set. Now, why are some cards missing from this set? Well, the legal battles with Bowman that were going on at the time. Bowman was able to get a few other players to sign exclusive contracts, so Topps couldn't use their likeness in the cards for that year's set. So that's the reason why some of those cards are missing. But what is out there is a collection of just some incredible cards, including the second year Mickey Mantle. Billy Martin. You've got some other top players as Warren Spahn, Yogi Berra, Pee Wee Reese, and you know, a lot of the other big players from that time. And it's a great design, as you saw, you know, great artwork on the front, a really beautiful design on the back too, where you're not only incorporating stats and text, but now you've got a cartoon as well, and it's just laid out absolutely beautifully. And even though Topps was in this big battle with Bowman and couldn't quite get some of the big names mixed in like they wanted to, the 53 set does endure, as I mentioned while we were looking at that Cliff Fannin card, in the form of the 1991 Topps Archive set, where they basically recreated the 53 set and created some faux back cards, if you will. Some cards for players like Hank Aaron. You know, if Hank Aaron had a 53 tops card, this is what it would have looked like. So they created a few new ones. Now, the battle between Topps and Bowman is going on into 1954, and Topps wins a huge victory in player contracts in Ted Williams. Williams at the peak of his career here in 1954, and to not only celebrate the Ted Williams signing, but to kind of rub it into Bowman's face, Topps produced two Ted Williams cards that were bookends for the 250 card set. So there is card number one and card number 250. And this is a very rare card because it was the first and last card of the set. As I've mentioned before, the low, low numbers and the high, high numbers are rare because are rare in finding in mint condition because a lot of kids, when they collected their cards, if they collected them in sequential order, they would wrap these rubber bands around it, and the rubber bands over time would just squeeze the cardboard and damage the sides of the card. So since those cards were typically a little more manhandled than, say, the middle of the stack, the first and last card of any set normally has some kind of a premium to it, especially these older sets, because of that damage. Now, Hank Aaron did have his first card in the 54 top set, so that is a key card from the set. And the 54 set, as I mentioned, if you listen to our episode number 69 in our archive, you'll get a little more detail on the 54 set. But it's one of my favorites because of the very innovative picture-in-picture, you know, having the painted stage shot, having the black and white action photo overlaying the stage shot, having the colorful background, the team logo. And I love the backs of these cards. They are just works of art. And, you know, you not only have the stats and the narrative, but the comic book panel almost, if you will, two or three panels describing this particular player. And one of the quirks, and I showed you the backwards backs, if you will. It was just the way that Topps laid out the cards. So if you try to organize them with the numbers all on one side, if you flip it over to the front, then you know one card is upside down when paired to the next. Also, an interesting quirk, all of these cards I have here are white back cards. They are aged a little bit, so they have a little bit of a grayish look to it. But for some reason, the first series of cards in 1954 in Canada were issued with gray cardstock. Eventually, the white cardstock also crept into some of the latter series in Canada. So if you're somebody who's searching for some unique variations, looking at white backs and gray backs is something that a lot of collectors do. They try to collect one of each to have the quote-unquote true full set, having the Canadian version with the gray backs. And those are a little harder to find, again, because those were primarily produced for the Canadian audience and also had the usual short print problems based on, you know, how Topps laid out 250 cards on a sheet. There were several cards that were short printed along the way. So some great sets if you can get your hands on some of the you know, start with some of the semi-star cards or the common cards. Those are certainly more affordable, a lot easier to get your hands on. But some beautiful cards for various reasons. The stunning 52 set, the imaginative 53 set, and then just the all-encompassing 54 set. And, you know, while Topps and Bowman are duking it out in court and getting these player contracts resolved, Bowman caught up to Topps in the sense of, okay, yeah, we can produce a bigger and full color photo card. Sure, look, but you look at 54 Bowman, which is better than 51 and 52, and you look at 54 Topps. I mean, Topps is just a mile ahead of the competition. And you'll see when we look at the 55 Topps cards in a few weeks. 55 Bowman had that legendary TV set look that's a classic all these years later. But 55 Topps was something even better than that, and even better than what 54 Topps was. So this is just the glory days of not only Major League Baseball, which is just having a post-war renaissance in the mid-1950s, but certainly for baseball cards. There are some works of art out there. And like I said, get your hands on some common cards. Don't be too much of a stickler for the condition. I mean, you want good, but not beat up cards here. And you can find them from several dealers or at your local card show for not a whole lot. You may end up investing, maybe $20 or so and, be able to come home with 8 or 9 cards from this time that are in, pretty darn good condition considering the age. And it's just something fun to have to your collection. Now let's briefly look back at the stories of some of these players. Vic Wirtz, if I mention Vic Wirtz, a lot of you are probably going, hey, I've heard that name somewhere. Well, it's not necessarily Vic Wirtz's name that you recall. It's the player he is associated with, and that would be the Say Hey Kid, Willie Mays. Yes, Vic Wirtz and Willie Mays forever linked for one of the not only best plays in World Series history, but in baseball history as well, as it was Vic Wirtz in Game 1 of the 1954 World Series. He was then playing for the Cleveland Indians. He hit a 420-foot line drive to center field, which in many other ballparks would have ended up as a home run, but the Polo Grounds was, I think, 434 feet to dead center. Believe it or not, Willie Mays is able to track that ball down on the run, and he makes the legendary over-the-head basket catch. And the throw back into the infield was just as impressive as the catch. And that pretty much summed up the Cleveland Indians that year. They won, I think, 111 games that year, but ended up getting swept by the Giants. For the Giants, that was their last World Series victory until 2010. So there was a really long dry spell there between New York in 1954 and San Francisco in 2010. But Vic Wirtz took the ignominy of being associated with a play like that rather well, actually. Very similar to Ralph Branca and Robbie Thompson with the shot heard around the world. Branca just took it in stride and often said, hey, if I didn't give up that home run to Bobby Thompson, many people would have forgotten about me. And, Wirtz would joke about it, say, well, if, Willie didn't make that catch, I may not be as well known as I am today. But Vic Wirtz grew into becoming a power hitter, and that was what he was best known for in his later years with Cleveland in particular. And he did have some power numbers to boast a little earlier on in his career, including 1952 or 1951, basically, with his 52 Topps card from Detroit. Interesting story with him heading into the 1955 season. He was stricken with polio. Fortunately for him, it was the non-paralysis strain, but it did sideline him for the entire season. But he was able to come back. He was actually in the Indians' opening day lineup for the 1956 season. His career slowed down a little bit afterwards, but he was able to play on through 1963, where he would go back to the Detroit Tigers. He was, after his playing career, involved in a distributing company, mostly a beer distributor for Miller Beer in Michigan. He was also a very charitable person, donated a lot of time and money to the Special Olympics throughout Michigan for many years. And in fact, the Wirtz Warriors still lives on even well after Vic Wirtz passed away in 1983. He was undergoing heart surgery and died after the procedure, July 7th, 1983. He was only 58 years old. Now, there was another tragic ending to Cliff Fannin, the player who is featured on the 53 Topps card I have here. Cliff Fannin actually died very, very young of a heart attack. In fact, he died in 1966. He was only 42 years old. Now, you look at the career numbers of Cliff Fannin, and there's not a whole lot to brag about. In fact, I've got him here. 8 seasons, all with the St. Louis Browns. So that was part of the problem. The Browns were not a very good team for many of the years he was there. He just missed out on the 1944 World Series team. But he did play in eight seasons, had a 34-51 record, and an earned run average of 4.85. Now, compared to other Browns pitchers, that actually wasn't too bad. But he has a very interesting story here, and I learned this from the website diamondsinthedusk.com. This is fascinating. On May 26th, 1952, Cliff Fannin was credited with losing two baseball games in two different leagues on the same day. Now, it all starts on April 20th. He is the starting pitcher for the Browns. The Browns are hosting the Chicago White Sox, and the Sox just knock Fannin and the Browns around. Fannin leaves the game with the Browns trailing 3-0. They lose 10-2, but they were losing 10-2, I should say. But the game is suspended in the bottom of the seventh because of darkness. Again, this is before every ballpark had lights installed. Well, 3 weeks later, the Browns decide to send Fannin down to AA San Antonio. Well, the second portion of the suspended Browns and White Sox game is resumed in St. Louis on May 26th. And eventually the White Sox are credited with a 10-5 victory. So Fannin, even though he pitched 5 weeks before in the first part of this game, he is officially credited with the loss. And as it would turn out, it was his final major league loss. He never made it back to the bigs after getting sent down to San Antonio. Well, here's the amazing thing. That exact same day in San Antonio, the Missions, I believe, was that their name back then? Yeah, they were still the Missions. So the Missions are hosting the Shreveport Sports. Fannin comes into the game as a reliever with San Antonio leading 2-1, but he gives up six runs and San Antonio loses the game 7-3. So on May 26th, 1952, Cliff Fannin has the dubious record of losing two games on the same day, not just in two different leagues, but in the major leagues and the minor leagues. So that is just mind-blowing when you look at Cliff Fannin. All right, let's take a look at the 54 Topps cards here. Actually, just three of them. Like I said, we already talked about Marian Fracano when we were looking at the Bowman cards a couple weeks ago. Johnny Logan, even though he was born in Endicott, New York, you could have called him Mr. Milwaukee because, as it turned out, the Braves scouted him. He was a letter in four sports in high school: baseball, basketball, track and field, football. In fact, he was a very good football player, was scouted by several NFL teams and some very good college programs as well, but he decided to pursue a major league career. The Boston Braves snap him up. The problem is the Boston Braves had Alvin Dark at shortstop, and he was in his prime. So poor Johnny Logan could not crack the big league lineup. Starting in the mid-1940s, he was a property of the Braves, but playing for the Milwaukee Brewers, who were then part of the American Association. And he would play minor league ball in Milwaukee for several seasons. And then finally, not only when the Braves moved to Milwaukee prior to the 1953 season, but they also decided to move on from Alvin Dark. Well, that opened up the door for Johnny Logan to take over the shortstop position, and that was a position that he held through 1961 in Milwaukee. So if you look at it, going back to 1947, when he started playing for the Brewers and then through the Milwaukee Braves days, he spent 14 years in Milwaukee as a shortstop, first in the minor leagues and then in the major leagues. And he was also part of a stellar infield of an up-and-coming Milwaukee Braves team in the 50s that featured Logan at short. And I'm looking particularly at the world champion team in 57 and the pennant-winning team in 58. You had Logan at short, Red Shandy at second, Eddie Matthews at third, and Joe Adcock at first. So you talk about power at the corners and solid defensive play up the middle. Doesn't get much better than that foursome. They were outstanding and consistent for several seasons. Eventually, the Braves decide to move on from Johnny Logan when they acquired Roy McMillan in a deal during the 1960 offseason. So Johnny Logan would go on to play for the Pittsburgh Pirates for a few seasons, then plays in Japan with the Nankai Hawks, a team that won the Japanese World Series. So Johnny Logan, one of the few players who could say that he won a World Series and a Japanese World Series in his career. In fact, the Japanese World Series victory came 7 years to the day that the Braves topped the Yankees in Game 7 of the 1957 World Series. Now, after his playing career, he got into sales with WOKY, a Milwaukee radio station. Not only got into sales, but got into hosting. He hosted his own talk show for a while. Briefly did some color analysis for the Milwaukee Brewers, the big league team, after the Pilots moved there in 1970. Experimented a little bit in some side projects. Also tried to get into politics. Wasn't extremely successful there. But he was a regular with the Brewers through the 1990s. In fact, was operating the radar gun for the Brewers at Old County Stadium for many, many years in the 90s, and was inducted into the Brewers Honor Roll in 2005. Passed away not that long ago, back in, 2013. And just like I said, Mr. Milwaukee, he was a longtime member of the Milwaukee baseball scene, first with the Brewers minor league team, then with the Braves, and then later with the Brewers major league team and their organization for many years. Now, the Bob Keeley card. Bob Keeley's got a hell of a story, too. And as I mentioned, it's not that often that you see a coach card, but it's not that often you get a story like Bob Keeley. Bob Keeley was a star in St. Louis, seemed destined to have a Major League Baseball career ahead of him. However, he suffered a major knee injury while practicing for the Cardinals in the hopes of playing for the Cardinals in, I think, 1937. It actually required surgery. And, you know, back in the mid-1930s, if you had an injury that was bad enough that required surgery, any kind of pro sports career was pretty much done. So he kind of came to that conclusion. He gets into the construction business and is doing stuff like tiling and painting and drywall type work. World War II happens. He is not drafted into the military because of his knee injury. And World War II opens the door for him. And we talked about this with some of the players in the Bowman show a couple weeks ago. The door opens. The Cardinals, by 1944, are looking for a third-string catcher. And Keeley was a catcher. And, you know, they're just so depleted in manpower by 1944, as was every other team. You know, they went back in their files and they said, hey, you know, there's this prospect named Keeley who got hurt. Let's see if we could just bring him back just to help the club out. So he was officially the third string catcher, but was also the bullpen coach and was part of, officially, the 1944 World Series team that beat the crosstown, you know, shared the same stadium rival, St. Louis Browns, for the victory there. Now, he was able to work himself into the lineup on July 25th, 1944, pretty interesting story here as well. The Cardinals' top two catchers were Walker Cooper and Ken O'Day. They're playing a game in Philadelphia, Shea Park, against the Phillies. Well, Walker Cooper is the starting catcher. He gets ejected by the home plate umpire in the bottom of the ninth inning. You know, here they are. They're one strike away from shutting out the Phillies. And Cooper gets ejected. Well, O'Day, as it turns out, was not with the team. His wife was sick, so he's back home with her. And all of a sudden, Bob Keeley gets pressed into action. So he catches two pitches, a ball and strike three, and that's it. So his major league debut was as a defensive replacement for two pitches. And he would earn his only at-bat in the major leagues in 1945. He popped out in his one and only big league at-bat. And then he becomes part of the coaching staff with the Boston Braves, as it turns out. Billy Southworth, who was the manager of the Cardinals during this time, moves on to Boston, takes Keeley with him. So Keeley is the bullpen coach and would be the bullpen coach throughout the team's successful seasons in 1957 and 1958. He would leave the team after, I think it was the 1960 season. He was having trouble seeing eye to eye with manager Fred Haney. Of course, he wasn't the only one. But this is a very unique card because, again, you don't see that many coach cards out there, especially for a bullpen coach. But also, you don't see that many cards produced in 1954 reflecting the lifetime record of the player who had one at-bat and caught two pitches and appeared in a grand total of two games in his major league career in 1944 and 45. I thought that was just a fascinating story there. Bob Keeley, by the way, if you're wondering, after his time with the Braves as a coach, moved down to Florida, where the Braves were spring training at the time, later became a scout for the Cardinals, would hold that job until 1978, and he passed away from the onset of dementia back in 2001 at the young age of 91. And finally, Bill Wehrle. Now, this is kind of from the Mariano Fricano school, or the Marion Fricano school of thought here. He was, Wehrle was known more for kind of the chip on his shoulder when he took the mound. He had a very lengthy career, mostly because he was a situational reliever, a left-handed pitcher, bounced around throughout several teams in the major leagues. But before he ended up in Boston in 1953 here, there's a mysterious controversy with Pittsburgh in 1952 during spring training. Wehrle was fined $500, suspended indefinitely, and put on the waiver list for officially breaking training rules. But there was never really any explanation as to what happened. And the Pirates were basically saying, screw him, he can leave the whole organization. Now, rumor mill had it that he was out drinking late, missed curfew, was canoodling with somebody other than his wife. And Branch Rickey, who was the GM then, even though he was very progressive and liberal, if you will, in terms of signing and bringing Jackie Robinson into the big leagues, Branch Rickey was a very conservative person. So if there was even any hint of some kind of wrongdoing such as this, Rickey just wanted him out from the club. And, you know, back in 1952, if you couldn't cut it with the Pittsburgh Pirates, you might as well just, you know, mop floors. You had no major league future. And while Wehrle would say that there was no fooling around, he did admit to missing his curfew, but he also suggested that he was being made the scapegoat. And sure enough, the Pirates would be able to move him on to St. Louis in the later stages of the 1952 season. Then the Red Sox pick him up in 1953. Now, he would struggle for a little bit in 1954, managed to hang around the big leagues for just a few more months, ended up finishing up his pro career in the Pacific Coast League in the late 1950s, moved on to a coaching and managing career, and then a very lengthy scouting career with the Baltimore Orioles. In fact, he scouted pitchers throughout much of the 1970s and 80s, briefly worked with the Cleveland Indians in the early 1990s, and is also the feature of a couple of articles about pro scouting. In 1984, the Boston Globe wrote a profile on him. Ron Borges was the author of that. And then Brent Kelly, while writing for Sports Collectors Digest, talked a little bit about Wehrle back in the 1990s. So I said that he was with the Indians for just the early 90s. Actually, I'm just checking my notes here. Actually, throughout the 1990s. So he was very active in baseball well after his playing career wound down, passed away in 2010 due to complications from Alzheimer's disease. So some very interesting stories about these very interesting cards. And as I said before, if you have the chance to pick up some vintage cards here, remember, unless they are star cards, most local card shops and card dealers, they don't make a ton of money off of these. So you could maybe even make an offer, say, hey, I'll clear these 20 cards from the mid-1950s for you. I'll give you $35 for them. And as long as, you know, that's not too far off whatever they're priced at, you could probably get a deal for it. So I strongly encourage checking that out. And yeah, you can buy lots of vintage cards on eBay. Just be very careful. Make sure that the seller has, you know, a very high user rating, you know, 100%. You know, really with eBay, if you really have to screw things up to not get 100% feedback. So keep that in mind with any purchases, especially unopened pack purchases. But, you know, the lots for vintage cards, you can find lots of 6 or 8 cards in various conditions for some pretty affordable rates from what I've seen. But check the card shows, check the local card shops, check estate sales too, garage sales. You never know. Sometimes some people just have, you know, a stack of these cards stored away in a box and somebody just wants them out of the house, and they could be yours if the price is right. Well, that'll do it for this week's show. Again, thanks so much for joining me as we look at these classic Topps cards from the beginning of the modern baseball card era, 1952. And it'll be fun looking at some more modern cards from the 1980s next week. Again, I've got 3 cello packs. They're very popular. I think you're going to like them. It's going to be a tough vote for you on Monday, but look for that poll on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and look for our next show where we open 2 of those 3 packs, your selections. That will be next Friday, with the show dropping at noon Eastern. Not only the audio podcast, but also the video link as well. And again, we are on Spotify, we're on Google Play now, as well as Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Blueberry. Please pass the word on, let everybody know that you can listen to Wax Ecstatic in so many ways now. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning into this week's edition of Wax Ecstatic. We'll talk next week.